Hi and welcome to the Insight podcast from British International Investment. In this podcast series, we share some of the highlights from one of our recent Insight events. These events aim to share practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge and research. And in today's episode, we're discussing investment in fragile and conflict-affected states as we welcome the economist and author Stefan Durkin as our guest. This conversation with Stefan is chaired by your host for today, our General Counsel, Colin Buckley.
I'm Colin Buckley from BII, and today I'm joined by Stefan Durkin. We're going to be talking about Stefan's new book, Gambling on Development, Investing in Fragile States. Over the last 30 years, in many developing countries, as we've discussed in other of these Insight events, we know that poverty has fallen, people live longer and healthier lives, and economies have been transformed. But this is not the case across the board. And today we are focusing on those countries that perhaps have been left behind. In his new book, Gambling on Development, Why Some Countries Win and Others Lose, Stefan Durkin, the former chief economist at the Department for International Development, policy advisor to foreign secretaries, and now professor of economic policy at the Blavatnik School of Government and the Economics Department, asks why some of the previously poorest countries have prospered while others have failed. He argues that development is most likely to happen when a country's elites want it to happen, what he calls a development bargain. Today we have Stefan with us to explore the implications of this thesis for the role of impact investors, including development finance institutions, in fragile and conflict-affected countries. Welcome, Stefan. It's great to have you here at BII, formerly known as CDC, I think the last time that you were here.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me here. I look forward to this conversation.
So, I mean, you bring to this Insight event, a combination of both an academic view, a practitioner's view, and also someone who is advised on policy. And let's start out with, you know, how those three different parts of your career have affected the way that you look at the problems of poverty and economic growth.
What's really interesting when you look around what academics typically do, and sometimes, you know, also even policy advisors in organizations, they love to try to say what should be done. You know, they're full of lists of prescriptions of the kind of policy that should be done, the kind of spending that should be done, and so on and so on. And I think one thing I have learned over the years, that this obsession with what needs to be done forgets an important part of, well, how can we get it done? You know, how to actually implement something, how to actually do something in practice. So there's definitely something, an appreciation of the difficulty of how to do things in practice. But the second thing is that the more I've worked, I think, in a policy environment, and there I say a political environment as advising ministers, you also have to ask in general, you know, why don't they do it? You know, why is it not happening? And it's sometimes too easy of academics to keep on having to have the long list of things that should be done. We have to ask ourselves, you know, why is it not happening? Because, you know, it's a wrong attitude, as sometimes in the development space we have, is to say, well, they don't really know what to do, and we'll need to just build their capacity or give the ideas and it will all happen.
Well, let's get to the book. First of all, I'll do the plug for you. This is what it looks like. It's available on Amazon. That's where I got my copy. And the core concept behind it is this notion of a development bargain. So let's start out with just explaining what that means.
So you can think of any society, our own, the US, European countries, or African societies, to somehow having people with, you know, power and influence in these societies. And I call these the elite. The elite are the kind of groups that have some power and influence. It's not just a political leader. It is business elites. It can be civil service elites. It can be senior people in financial institutions. It can be academics. Okay, I have to kind of say, probably I'm touching occasionally, even in the UK. However, it's quite a broad elite. You know, you're part of that in some sense as a senior academic and so on. So it's a broad group of people. But they shape somehow the direction of a country, and they can do that in all kinds of various ways. And what I refer to is that thinking of what's going on in every society, in every country, is that somehow or another, unless it's totally fragmented and breaking down, there is some form of bargain between these groups. Not necessarily that everybody agrees in it, but broadly speaking, certain elements. I would say we live in a society where, you know, it's quite important that the economy is rather sound, where there is not too much unemployment, that prices are not increasing too fast, and so on. So that's part of that kind of elite bargain in this society that virtually anyone would probably agree with in the elite, in the politics, and so on. Now, you can have, of course, various versions of it. You could have places where money really talks, as in totally in control. You could have extreme capitalist societies where politics can end up being bought. You can have societies where there's much more restrictions on that, where, for example, inheritance rights are actually quite limited, so that if you happen to have an ancestor that was important in the 13th century, you're not necessarily rich today. Of course, we have lots of society where this is the case. So we all have our rules, our economic, political deals in around it. So where do I get to that? Well, if you want development and want growth, somehow or another, within that elite bargain, it needs to be strong enough commitment to actually want it. Now, we shouldn't take it for granted that every society or the elite that controls it wants it. You know, we do have kleptocracies where actually the main purpose of the leaders in that society is to actually just steal as much they can and actually put it away. You have also places where clientelism is the basis on which the state is built, where basically the state is an instrument to reward those who supported you and to give them jobs and so on. And these are then particular types of countries. So you don't have to take for granted that the underlying elite bargain is about growth and development. So I just wanted to simply point that out, that without that underlying commitment for growth and development amongst the elite, we won't see that much happening. And in fact, one of the contentions in my book, and I call this the presence of a development bargain, that if we look around the world in very diverse societies who have done reasonably well starting from takeoff in the last 3-4 decades, from the Indonesias, the Bangladeshes, the Chinas, or maybe Ghana, and maybe Ethiopia until quite recently, growing fast, doing reasonable things for development, the common element is really that fundamentally those with power and influence in the society somehow or another at least valued growth and development quite substantially. And I made this a minimal precondition for development, because without that, we're not going to get very far.
Yeah. I mean, it's very rich in a lot of implications. I mean, it is a simple concept, this notion of a sort of an agreement. But I was struck by a number of kind of questions as I went through. The first one is, you're very careful to talk about elites, where traditionally we talk about governments. And I wonder whether there is an insight there that perhaps as development actors, we have focused too much on governments, and we really need to start recognizing who drives these types of bargains in some of these countries.
No, so absolutely right. And of course, you know, the first group that you don't definitely have to think about is, you know, who controls business in this and who controls the economy in the society. You know, you can have countries where actually politics is quite weak and quite fragmented, but actually the business community will determine, broadly speaking, the direction where it is going. Also slightly the other way around, you know, I'm talking in the book about Somaliland, and I like to talk about Somaliland because I find it really interesting, where the business elite actually more or less decreed at some point we're going to have peace and stability, and they paid for all the negotiations amongst the sub-clans, and they are still the guarantors of actually quite a lot of peace and stability in that society. So, you know, you can have very different ways than it plays out. But yes, it's not just, we too much look at who is the president and what words does she or he speak. You know, these words don't mean that much. It's often that kind of implicit understanding of how this country works that is governing senior civil servants, that is governing business elite and politics, that actually is far more important. So yeah, you have to look a bit broader and understand the connections, the networks with power in these places before you can actually begin to understand where is this country going.
Yeah, and we often kind of expect that the move to economic growth, the move to the consequent poverty reduction, it comes alongside general improvements in the country and improvements in the political area. But you've used some examples where that's not true. And you know, that it is possible that an elite may come to an economic determination that they can maximize their rent seeking from in the short term by, or potentially the long term, by opening up to economic growth. And I'm curious now, wearing your policy hat, about where that puts us. I mean, is it true then that we really do have to hold our nose every now and then and commit to a sort of a suboptimal government in order to achieve that economic growth?
So the way I would put it is that if you look historically at development and growth, you know, look at the UK, you know, we had all our rotten boroughs in the 19th century and until late, and we had all this kind of political game playing and rent seeking of people that controlled and close to power. You know, most societies during their periods of growth and development seem to have that. So, and it's actually the more general point is that it's really quite naive to simply say, well, we need to get perfect institutions and then we can start growing and developing the economy, because it's actually no country had these by the time it started doing this, you know, and that's somehow where I might want to say, you know, I'm not saying that you should be happy with the imperfection, that you would say I'm hooray for corrupt behaviors in certain things, but actually you want to put this much more in a broader context and say, okay, where is this going now? What role do some of these, and I mentioned corruption and other things, playing this? And is there a way to actually understand, at least without condoning it, that this is actually somehow somehow part of an imperfection, but an attempt to actually move forward? So we sometimes think everything needs to be perfect and we want to address it all in one go. You know, that's not how societies typically evolve. Now, let me give an example to help you with that. Is that, so if you go back to the Indonesian in the early 1970s, they came out of conflict. Suharto came to power then with a military coup. The original elite really hated it. Yeah, he definitely didn't have legitimacy with the old elite, who had been very much supporting Sukarno and the whole nationalist idea, but it was all ideology dominating and the economy had actually stagnated. And in fact, the uprising in the 60s were very well explained, partly also through actually really people didn't see their lot improving. So you get a new person in power that actually has no legitimacy with the old elite. He has the military support. He has no legitimacy yet with the population, but maybe some expectations. So he had to play that game very carefully. And actually, you know, arguably they wanted to progress. They did invite Japanese investment in. You actually, once you do that, you start creating new elite players, you know, that can actually benefit from this. So what you do with the old elite that could kick him out almost any time? Well, he let the old elite more or less in control of some of these old state-run enterprises, including Petromina, which is the parastatal in charge of oil,
right,
which even up to today is an incredibly corrupt organization. And so you understand a little bit, like, you know, this was actually quite clever power play. I'm not saying that I condone the corruption in there, but actually it was one way of actually keeping the bargain together that allowed a lot of these growth things to come in, these new things come in, without creating the total destabilization that could have resulted if the old elite kept on really being against him, because he wouldn't have stayed in power. There would have been another coup and whatever. So you can understand that progress needs somehow very clever ways of playing around it. And that's in a way, you know, to keep the elite bargain together. And that's that coalition that he did quite cleverly, clearly.
Now. Right. I mean, this creates a complex problem, though, for especially for Western countries like the UK, facing what their development agenda should be in these institutions. So I mean, what are the guidelines that you think we should adopt when we're faced with a, in a sense, malevolent political actor who, for their own designs, is following a policy that we think will probably be good for the people of that country in the long term?
Look, you guys are very good at weighing risks and returns and thinking about incentives and so on. So think of it in the context of also of the politics in places like this. Okay, so how do we get the upside of those players in the elite that want a real development bargain to actually go up? And how can we actually make sure that the returns to the elites that just want a status quo and no progress are not going up, but if anything, we can bring them down? So one way you can think about it is that the kind of companies that are closely connected to government, they live typically of the rents. And I know you wouldn't typically necessarily invest in them. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But in any case, in the first instance, what you want to actually see can actually strengthen the kind of the rents and the profits that can be created, can be generated from those who actually do genuine investments and actually do profitable things. So you actually can say, can I increase the upside of those players in the elite that actually mean it well? Well, you can do that actually by supporting some of them by an FCDO or as a DFID or as a World Bank. You work with those technocrats who generally are strengthening these kinds of things. But if you do it as an investor, you know, you don't pick out the non-tradables that live totally from protection and control of the international markets, but you actually say, well, if I can find a firm that I can support that actually is doing tradables, that actually is willing to compete internationally, well, obviously have a bigger upside. So you strengthen, increase, you actually look for ways that you not just get a good return to it, but you actually look at it in the kind of firms that are consistent with more developmental growth-oriented agenda.
Yeah.
And so you play that game, not, and you know, you pick your investments, of course, where the upside is high, but you pick them at the same time with an eye on how does that play out if these players in that sector get bigger. And you will see that probably without knowing some of the firms you invest in, because they're not typically the connected firms, you actually are probably strengthening the opportunities for better development bargains. Or similarly, you may work with state-owned enterprises, but you probably want to do it with those players within it who actually want these becoming actually firms again rather than connected business. And so you can actually work with them and you actually strengthen the ability for players who actually want these firms to be sensible firms to actually to strengthen it. And it's you can play that game as well. So you can, whether it's FCDO or World Bank, you very carefully pick your investments, but you keep in mind how do these investments or these development projects more in general strengthen those who actually really want growth and development and weaken those who just want the status quo and just pure rent seeking.
Thank you very much for listening to this podcast from British International Investment. The full recording of this event with input from Vivian Infante, Director of the Africa Resilience Investment Accelerator, and Paddy Carter, our Director of Research and Policy, is available to watch on our YouTube channel. You can find a link to it in the episode notes. And also in the episode notes is a link to subscribe to our monthly Insight newsletter. That's it from us today. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.